couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. We've got this very diverse group of films to talk about today. We got kids' movies and non-rated movies because of sexual innuendo and scenes in them. We've got art house films. We've got popular fiction. We're kind of hitting all bases on this one, and that's one of the most exciting things about the movies in a weekend like this, is because there is kind of something for everybody out there. And if you have a family that has been spending too much time together, you can all go to the theater and see something totally different and not have to interact with each other and avoid family dysfunction. That is the service that Hollywood provides. We're also going to be talking about some Star Wars and superhero news. We got the trailer park. We've got the winner in the Blu-ray giveaway contest. So congratulations. That'll be coming up in a later segment. We also have the DVD roundup, where I'm going to talk about some of the DVDs that are out, Blu-rays as well. There's some good pickings this week. Let's talk about how you can get a hold of me first, though. If you want to email me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/, you guessed it, fatguysatthemovies. I also just started an Instagram account. I know I'm way behind the times on this. I started the Instagram account because there was a giveaway for the Muppets, and you had to post your picture on Instagram. You couldn't do it like through Twitter or Facebook, so I had to get an Instagram account. And that's Instagram/FatGuysAtTheMovies. Pretty easy to remember. Finally, if you want to reach me on Twitter, you can go to twitter.com/KevinCarr, where I tweet stuff throughout the week and on the weekends. If you're a little bit offended, easily offended, don't go there this weekend because my profile picture hints at the nymphomaniac poster. I know that has now horrified the entire audience, and you have these images burning into your brain. It's really not as bad as what you're imagining, but it's worse than if you just kind of swerve in there and go, what's that all about?
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Anyways, we've got Ron Burgundy here telling us it's time to go to news. The first piece, and we haven't talked about Star Wars news in a while, so why not? Why not hit some Star Wars news? Two things that were big announcements this week with Star Wars. First of all, the fact that they are going to start shooting this summer in May. So the Star Wars script is done, it's ready to go, and they're ready to start principal photography in England. Of course, the big thing I saw reported is R2-D2 is back. Big surprise. R2-D2 has been in every movie, and he doesn't seem to be going anywhere. He shows up in everything Star Wars. I mean, they could have, I would imagine, you know, Knights of the Republic, these old school Star Wars games that take place long before the movie Star Wars took place. He probably shows up in those things somehow. So that's cool. I mean, I'm excited for Star Wars. I'm a big Star Wars fan. The other thing is, it's been announced, not the script. The script is still kind of under wraps in the characters and who plays whom, but it's been announced that the script takes place 30 years after Return of the Jedi, which, by the way, is almost 30 years ago this year. It was 30 years ago last year in 2013. That Return of the Jedi was released. It was released in 1983, which is cool because now when you bring back Luke Skywalker and Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia and Harrison Ford as Han Solo, the fact that they're old farts is not going to be shocking to you. You should be like, well, they're old people now because it's been 30 years. But it takes place 30 years after Jedi. There's a lot of speculation about who it's about, because it's reportedly about a trio of new people. You've got familiar faces as well, and those are the old school people. I mean, R2-D2's in it. I'm sure 3C-3PO is going to show up. But you also have, you know, Luke and Leia and Han Solo. They're all talked about reprising their roles. A lot of people are saying, is this going to be about Han Solo and Princess Leia's kids, Jaden and Jason, from the extended universe? I don't know, because here's the thing. The extended universe is not canon with the movies, and there are some differences. And so you cannot just assume that because it was written in extended universe fiction in either comic books or novels or the role-playing games, that this stuff's actually going to, they're not necessarily going to follow these stories. And I don't think they should, because if all they're going to do is just rehash all the stories that we've already had circulating around for the last 25 years, it's not all that interesting. I want to see some new stuff. And it's kind of sky's the limit. They can go wherever they want to. They're not shackled by the extended universe stuff. And that's a good thing. The other piece of news I want to hit, Ghostbusters 3 is apparently a go. Not weeks after Harold Ramis passes, Sony has said that they're going on with Ghostbusters 3, which is a terrible idea. It's just, this is the worst idea ever, because it's so past its time. I mean, Ghostbusters 2 came out in like 1989. I mean, decades ago. The Ghostbusters 3 is an unnecessary thing. And Ivan Reitman's not going to be in it. He's going to be producing, but he's not going to be directing. And a lot of people are kind of up in arms about that. But have you seen Ghostbusters 2? That's not very good either. Harold Ramis is, of course, not going to be in it because he's dead. They're looking at an early 2015 production schedule. This is going to be a terrible movie and a bad idea. Speaking of sequels, two other sequels I just want to mention that are coming out. Incredibles 2, Disney has announced that it is being written by Brad Bird. It's a go for that. And that's awesome because I love The Incredibles. I think you can do more stuff with them. They're not a locked story that begins and ends and can go no further. And it also has Brad Bird behind it. And Brad Bird did some fantastic movies. You know, Iron Giant, Ratatouille, The Incredibles, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. This guy's a good filmmaker. So having him at least writing it, maybe he'll direct it. That'd be nice, but... You know, hey, I have faith in Pixar. Also, Cars 3 is coming. And now the internet kind of blew up and people were like, oh, how dare you do Cars 3? Cars 2 was fine. Most people who don't like the Cars movies think they're too much for kiddies. And they are. They're aimed at a young audience. And they don't like Larry the Cable Guy. I'm okay with that. And I actually thought Cars 2 was pretty good. So doggone it. You know, people, quit being hypocrites. If you're going to be excited about Incredibles 2, you can't diss Cars 2 or Cars 3. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. It means we're moving into the trailer park. Let's park this bucket and get going. The first one I want to hit is The Machine. And there's a couple other trailers that were sort of a little more dramatic that have come out. But anyone who knows me knows I'm a big science fiction fan. So there are two sci-fi movies I want to hit, and they're somewhat similar in tone and dystopian outlook. The first is The Machine. It opens on April 25th.
You make weapons for the government?
No. I make intelligent machines. Open your eyes. It's incredible. It's conscious.
Conscious machines are dangerous. This machine has the potential to be so much more than just a soldier.
They're afraid of you. They think you're too human.
I find this interesting because I love AI stories. I love stories where people are trying to do good and better society, and it goes horribly awry, and just, it's a bad idea. And that's also, this year looks like it's going to be a fantastic year for science fiction. And I'm not talking about some nonsense like The Purge. I'm talking about Transcendence. You're going to have this, The Machine coming out. There's a bunch of movies that are slated to come out that look like they might actually be a lot of fun and and very innovative. I've loved very smart science fiction, and it's good to see that. So I'm actually looking forward to The Machine. It's funny, if you actually watch a trailer, you don't see this, but in the trailer, they fuzz out all the naughty bits of the woman who plays the artificial human, because apparently she's walking around naked, because robots don't care if they're nude. So, but it's a good trailer. I encourage you to seek this one out, and I'm looking forward to this one in about a month. The next one I want to talk about is The Signal, which opens on June 13th. You'll hear it actually almost sounds like a similar trailer. It could have been cut together. But anyways, here it is.
Can you tell me your name?
Nicholas Eastman.
Are you from Earth?
Yes, I'm from Earth.
What I'm about to tell you, Nick, you may find a bit disturbing. Can you recall for me the first time you encountered the signal?
The what?
You're not 100% certain about what we're dealing with here.
There have been several movies called The Signal. That have come out over the years. There was one that was made, about 10 years ago, a really innovative horror film about a signal that causes people to kind of lose their mind. It's very similar to Stephen King's Cell, the book Cell, if you've ever read that. This is not that movie. This is a different one. It stars Lawrence Fishburne, and I love him in science fiction movies. He's kind of a favorite little genre cash for him that I like. I mean, he was in Event Horizon, obviously The Matrix. You know, he plays good in science fiction movies. And once again, this looks like he's very smart, looks very speculative. What's funny is I can't even tell you what this is about. I watched the trailer a couple times. I edited it into here. I don't know what this movie's about. It certainly looks interesting, and I'm down for it. It opens June 13th, so middle of the summer. This will be a good place for a very smart science fiction movie. It's time to go. I have to hit a break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking about The Grand Budapest Hotel and Nymphomaniac Volume 1. Kevin Carr, Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling through the show. That music you hear is from Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel. And if you know anything about his movies and you're a fan of his, you'll recognize it. This is very typical Wes Anderson type of music. And The Grand Budapest Hotel is one of those movies that is made for the fans of Wes Anderson. It does not disappoint. Let's get into start talking about this right now. In a swanky European hotel, a concierge and a lobby boy get caught up in a web of murder and art thievery.
This is Madame D's last will and testament. To Monsieur Gustave H., I bequeath a painting known as Boy with Apple.
Wow.
What?
Who's Gustave H.?
I'm afraid that's me, darling.
If I learn you ever once laid a finger on my mother's body, living or dead...
I go to bed with all my friends.
Hide this. It's in code and you might need a magnifying glass to read it, but it tells you exactly where and how to find Boy with Apple.
Have you ever been questioned by the authorities?
Yes, on one occasion.
What?
I was arrested and tortured by the rebel militia after the desert uprising.
Right. Well, you know the drill then. Zip it.
Let me just start by saying, if you don't like Wes Anderson, because I know there are people out there who either like a director or don't like a director, especially one that's incredibly stylized, like Wes Anderson. There, you know, there's some like Tim Burton and Michael Bay and, you know, Stanley Kubrick back when he was around. Any of these directors have a very distinct style that you can watch 5 minutes of any of their movies and recognize that it's one of their films. And Wes Anderson's like that. His stuff's very symmetrical and it's very deliberate and it's framed. So it's very quirky and bizarre and weird and dry. If you don't like his stuff, avoid this movie because you will think it's terrible. I personally love Wes Anderson. I like all his films, but I gotta say, I'm not a huge fan of Bottle Rocket and Rushmore, which were his first two, and a lot of people just love, love, love Rushmore. But I don't think he came into his own as a mature filmmaker until he made The Royal Tenenbaums about 15 years ago. And that is when he really blossomed. That is when he found his style. That is when he found his niche of how he's going to do stuff. You see hints of it. Bottle Rocket's relatively straightforward and mainstream in terms of movie making. It's an indie film from the 90s, but it still feels like just a regular film. It doesn't feel like a Wes Anderson movie as much as his later ones. And then, of course, Rushmore, you really start to see his style starting to come out there. And with Tenenbaums, it galvanized his style and... His movies have all been very similar in this way, and you have other, you know, movies like, this is coming off of Moonrise Kingdom, which was nominated for an Oscar, and that's a brilliant movie on its own as well. It's very charming and beautiful, and what I love about his movies is they're warm-hearted and sweet and loving, and you feel comfortable watching them, even when there's unpleasant things happening, even when something's happening to characters that you realize that you don't want this to happen to the characters. You know, if there's sad things happening, if somebody dies or if there's a sad element to the story or a tragic element to the story, it still feels comforting being surrounded by the film. And that's how I can describe a Wes Anderson movie. This is one that switches around the aspect ratios because it takes place in three different time periods, like the 60s. And then I think it's like the 30s and then there's modern day. And they switched the three different aspect ratios, which, of course, is making projectionists who don't know what they're doing kind of go bonkers. But if you see it done properly, it's a beautiful movie because a good chunk of it takes place in that Academy framed 4:3, which is what you see on an old-fashioned TV. That aspect ratio, which a lot of people in cinemaphiles poo-poo because they say, oh, this is not... this doesn't look widescreen. It doesn't have the scope. But if you watch like older movies like Metropolis, or if you watch something like Dracula or the original Frankenstein, these movies used the vertical as much as they used the horizontal. So there's a brilliant way to shoot in that frame, and Anderson does that. So you don't feel like you're watching a TV show. You feel like you're still watching a movie that's very cinematic. There's a rich production design. It's gorgeous looking. The colors are amazing. It's got some fantastic performances with a cast that's way larger than I can name right now. Ralph Fiennes plays the main character. You've also got Jeff Goldblum in it. You've got Willem Dafoe, Adrian Brody. You've got Bill Murray showing up. You got a just nonstop cavalcade of great names behind this movie. This is a quintessential Wes Anderson movie. It's one of the best ones he's done. And I love, as much as I love Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is a bit of a diversion from his movies because it's animated, this has the same charm and style and look and feel as Tenenbaums did. And as much as I love even Moonrise Kingdom, this thing is so far beyond it with some very dense plotting going on, some very interesting character changes. This movie made a lot of noise recently because it's had limited releases in smaller cities, and it's just like, am I making $1 million a screen? It's just doing extremely well. And now it's going wider and wider this week and next week. So if you haven't had a chance to see Grand Budapest Hotel, check it out. It's a gorgeous movie. It's a beautiful movie. One of Wes Anderson's best. It totally, totally, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
Next, we got to talk about a little bit of a controversial movie here. We've got Nymphomaniac Volume 1. And this is Lars von Trier's movie. It's his follow-up to Melancholia. And this guy's never been ashamed of press or controversy. You know, he said some controversial Nazi-sympathetic things at Cannes back when he was promoting Melancholia. And, of course, he did Antichrist, which is considered very graphic and weirdly sexual at times. He goes dipping back into the sexual pond for Nymphomaniac. Now, it's a four-hour-long movie, and it's split into two volumes. So we got the first volume, which is available now on VOD, as well as in select theaters. In Nymphomaniac Volume 1, a hypersexual woman confesses the sins of her life to a complete stranger who helps her out when she's injured.
As a young girl, I discovered I was a nymphomaniac.
Well, that's nothing to smile about.
If you have wings, why not fly?
And was starting to have trouble remembering who was who.
I've thought about you often.
Have you thought of me?
You can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs.
Wow. It was rebellious.
What did you rebel against?
Love.
As much as I'm a huge Wes Anderson fan, I would not categorize myself as a Lars von Trier fan. I haven't seen too many of his films. I've seen a handful of them. And he's very much an art house director. And he comes from that Dogme 95 movement, I believe, where it's about conversation. And his movies get very talky at times, and they sometimes can be extremely dry. This is, of course, obviously building on the notorious nature of just the name Nymphomaniac and the fact that it has lots of sex. And you see graphic sex happening. Apparently, they use body doubles. So when you see stuff, you know, things entangled with other things, it's not Shia LaBeouf or Stacey Martin. It's body doubles, probably from the pornographic community. But anyways, there are some extremely graphic moments in this film. But there's a lot more to it. And at times it gets overly art house-ish, where it's sort of comparing the sex to something mundane like fly fishing. And there's some obvious choices to say things about how human culture deals with sex and taboo and when is enough too much and how is it related to love. And for example, like the main character, her name's Josephine, but she is shortened it to Jo, which is as minimal as you can get from a long name, which means in her character itself is minimized to just her sexual appetite. There's an entire life of hers in work and other things that they never even take a nod to. It's just about her sex life. And that is all that she is in this movie. Their character's minimized, her name's minimized. So there's these sort of symbolic things happening. But overall, it's an interesting movie. I'm curious to see where it goes. I hope that it doesn't end prematurely. But it's not as shocking as you'd think. I mean, yeah, you see some pretty graphic stuff. But, you know, in this day and age where, you know, the most extreme sex you can imagine is a couple keystrokes away, if this had come out in the 80s, it would have been much more scandalous. It's not breaking the taboos, but it's living within the taboos. Ultimately, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Oh, gosh, we're up against a break. We got to go. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Divergent and Muppets Most Wanted. Guys of the Movies, coming back at you with Kevin Carr. We're talking about Nymphomaniac and the Grand Budapest Hotel. Let's move on to the huge movies that are open this weekend, the ones that they're expecting to be blockbusters, or at least hoping. The first one is Divergent. In a dystopian future, a girl finds that she doesn't fit into society's five factions of the population and becomes a target because of it.
The only way you can survive is for each of you to claim your rightful place.
Everyone is tested to determine who we are and where we belong.
Your results were inconclusive.
That's impossible.
It's not impossible. It's just extremely rare.
you're able to control and conquer your fears. They call it divergent. You don't fit into a category. They can't control you.
This is the latest attempt for Hollywood to spin a young adult book series into a blockbuster series. And we saw the same sort of thing happen back when the Harry Potter movies became huge. And after a couple of them, Hollywood was looking for the next book. And they're like, let's try Aragon. Let's try Secret Darkest Rising. Let's try Percy Jackson. None of these really panned out. And it wasn't until they got to Twilight that they finally got a big juggernaut kind of film. And then after Twilight, they were scrambling to find it, and they got Hunger Games. And now that the Hunger Games is only four movies long, it's only three books, four movies, they're scrambling to find something else. And because ultimately, you know, Warner Brothers has Harry Potter, but Lionsgate and Summit have Twilight, Hunger Games, and now Divergent. They're trying to continue their empire here. The problem is, Harry Potter is very easy to understand. Boy Wizard goes wizarding school. Boom, there you go. You know, Twilight, even as much as I hated the Twilight movies, it's, you know, hey, it's the vampire love story. Love triangle with a werewolf. Boom, there you go. It's pretty easy to encapsulate. Hunger Games, a girl has to fight to the death to save her family in a dystopian future. Boom, there you go. This is easily explained. That description I gave of Divergent it's the most convoluted plot, and the background isn't very good. Now, this is going to do very, very well with the target market. The fans of the books are probably going to love this movie. I've heard other people talk, and here's where I have some problems or some worries here. My wife's a huge fan of the book. And she has been angry. She's been angry at me ever since I sort of turned my nose up at the trailer saying, this doesn't look too good. And she's kind of always been grumpy at me. And I went and saw the press screening, and she's going to go see it this weekend herself. And I don't know if we're going to talk about it. She's not happy. And she's probably going to turn off this part. I imagine she'll skip this little bit where I talk about this movie and come back and listen to what I have to say about the Muppets. But when it comes to Divergent, I have not read the book, so I can't comment on the book, and I can't comment on how well it's been translated and if there's been any changes, but I'm taking the straight at just face value of the book. It just seems so desperately trying to be Hunger Games, but at the same time, it's coming off more like The Host from last year, which was that movie with Saoirse Ronan based on a Stephanie Meyer book, where it was basically Invasion of the Body Snatchers in a cave in the dystopian future. This one, They're trying to tackle politics, like Hunger Games did, but it's a totalitarian system. In this movie, they're like, well, it's not really a totalitarian system, and somehow there was this war, and it's been 100 years, and they're only in Chicago, there's no contact to the outside world, they have a giant wall for something to protect them from, I don't know. I don't know what they're protecting themselves for. The world building in this has not been done well. And that's one of the essential things you need in a science fiction movie. You need to have that background so people don't say, wait, why is, like, oh yeah, there's this wall, they're protecting people. What are you protecting us from? You know, unless it's like a big hidden secret, if that's the secret, like in the movie The Village, the M. Night Shyamalan movie The Village, that was the secret. I don't know why they have this wall there. I don't know why they can't communicate with other cities. Are there other cities? What happened? What was this World War III? And if it is World War III, why is Chicago still doing okay? And then they split everybody into these five different factions, which is ultimately basically putting a Myers-Briggs personality test on everybody and saying, well, you go here and here and here and here. But if you've ever taken personality tests, everybody's on a continuum. They're not harshly into one quadrant or the other. So I don't understand this whole, I don't understand the uniqueness of the divergence in this, because she's kind of uncategorizable. Well, there's people like that. When I actually test very somewhere near the middle, where I can kind of, I'm as a bit of a chameleon. I can go into different quadrants if I want to deal with people from those quadrants in personality tests. So that's not uncommon. Yet they have these divergences. They never explain why the divergences are bad. They're like, well, because we can't control you, but they really don't get into any sort of explanation of what's the real threat. I mean, to the point that they want to kill these people, they don't explain that until like 2 hours into the movie. And then when they do, I'm like, well, that's flimsy. And that's only for this very limited plot point. Why else were they killing divergents 10, 20 years ago? It just doesn't make sense. It's very dumbed down when it comes to how they present the politics. It's very dumbed down how it presents human nature. And it's desperately trying to put in a romance in there that's very awkwardly just sort of shoehorned in and doesn't quite work. And, you know, it's hit you over the head with this, the message of, oh, don't put me in the corner. Don't categorize me. I'm a unique person. Here's why, like, Katniss Everdeen as the heroine in The Hunger Games, why she's better than Triss Pryor in Divergent. Tris Prior is like Bella, where they're like, oh, you're just kind of this mundane nothing of a person, but you are ultimately so special, you're going to save everybody. Whereas Katniss Everdeen was like, you're just an average person in this crappy little district. You're thrown into these horrible situations and you just persevere. She has real leadership and hero qualities because she reacts to stuff as a person, not as a prophecy. And they make this character of Triss in Divergent more of a prophecy. And it's, like I said, it just doesn't hold water. I mean, it's smart enough for like a 13-year-old kid to read the book and enjoy it. And that's not a diss on 13-year-old kids. But if you want to go past your fan base and get new viewers and older viewers and more mature and more sophisticated viewers and get to a mainstream level, you got to give us more than this, because it's just pretty ridiculously bad at times. There's other things. I could go on, but I'm running out of time. Anyways, Divergent kind of sucks. It give it just a little bit of edge because it's better than Twilight.
It kind of sucks.
Okay. Anyways, let's move on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's talk about Muppets Most Wanted. In this irreverent sequel, Kermit the Frog is kidnapped and sent to a Russian gulag by the world's most dangerous amphibian, who is trying to pull off a jewel heist.
There must be some mistake. I'm Kermit the Frog. I'm not Constantine.
You're going to be here a while.
I am Kermit.
And now you guys have all the freedom you want.
Dominic, international tour manager.
Dominic, bad guy?
Bad G. It's French.
Oh. My name will go down in history as greatest thief of all time.
You mean our names, right?
Of course. My name first, then spacebar, 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 your name.
What I loved about this from conception stage is they fixed a problem with the first Muppets from 2.5 years ago. And that was, in the first Muppets, they had the main characters were Jason Segel and Amy Adams. And I think they're great actors. Jason Segel's very funny. Amy Adams is beautiful and talented. I'm sure she's a wonderful girl. But she's not a Muppet. And neither is, and Jason Segel's a little bit closer to a Muppet, but he's still not a Muppet. He's a human being. And there was a whole section of the Muppets, the first one, where we kind of, the Muppets check out and they're kind of gone for 10 minutes. And I'm like, wait, I thought I'm watching the Muppets, not this guy and his girlfriend, the movie. This movie's about the Muppets. Yes, it has human stars in it. It has Tina Fey and Ty Burrell and Ricky Gervais and a bunch of other people kind of in smaller roles, and then a whole slate of cameos. But it's about the Muppets. They're all secondary to them. And you never see, there's not like a story arc for Tina Fey that takes her away from the Muppets for any considerable amount of time. Same thing with Ricky Gervais. Every time you see Ricky Gervais, his story is dependent on Muppets. That makes a good Muppet movie. Second of all, it still captures that irreverent humor. It captures that tongue-in-cheek, we can nod at the audience that they've always had in the Muppet movies. Somewhat meta at times, very meta at times. And it is a like the first series of Muppet movies. The second one, it was a caper, and it's not meant to be this touching, sweet, lovable story. Those are great stories, but you can't do that in every single episode. And this one is about a fun little goofy international thriller. It's a cute little movie. It's got a lot of funny moments. It's got some great songs in it. And like I said, the human cast is very funny. I think Ty Burrell's auditioning it through this to be the next Inspector Clouseau, because he plays an Interpol agent, and he's paired with Sam the Eagle, which is a brilliant pairing and hilarious. I love this movie. I might have even liked it more than the first Muppets. It doesn't have that heart. I mean, it has heart, but it doesn't have the heart opened up for everybody to see the way the first Muppets does. But you don't need that in every single Muppet movie. So good for you, Disney. You did a smashing sequel. The Muppets Most Wanted totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Gotta go to a break. When we come back, I'm gonna be talking about box office, a little bit more news, and a winner of our Blu-ray giveaway leading into the DVD roundup. Fat Guys of the Movies, rolling into our final segment. We're going to be talking about some videos and some box office and some news, and also the winner of our Blu-ray contest. So we'll get some congratulations in order and send that movie out to educate this person about aliens and ancient cultures, because that's important. It's not exactly Cosmos, guys, but it's an interesting show, Ancient Aliens. But before we do that, let's talk about the box office winners. And was I correct? I said 200 million. No, it's not 200 million. Oh, my God, heaven. This movie's not even going to make 200 million. 20 million for 300 Rise of the Empire. That's what I thought was going to win. I was pretty doggone close because that made 19.2 million. But kind of the surprise of the weekend was Mr. Peabody and Sherman jumping up ahead where it was beat out by a 300 Rise of an Empire the previous weekend. It ended up topping with almost 22 million. So my number was correct. The placement of Mr. Peabody and Sherman was better. That basically meant it held way better than 300. It only dropped like 30%, whereas 300 dropped like 60%. Need for Speed, which people were sort of like wondering whether that was going to do well, did not. It made just under 18 million, which is not very good for a big movie like this, that where it was needing to be a Fast and the Furious starting franchise. There were just so many ways that they went wrong. Kind of the way I think Divergent wants to be the Hunger Games, but it's sort of tripped. Every single time it's tried, because it's getting almost the exact same release date 2 years later from the first Hunger Games movie. But, you know, it's not as strong of a book. It's not as mainstream of a book. It's not as good of a concept. The actors aren't as strong in there. And a lot of the actors they have in Divergent are like TV actors. I mean, you got Coney Goldwyn, who plays, what is he best known for? Killing Patrick Swayze in Ghost back in 1990. Now he's the president on Scandal. So he's kind of a TV actor. And same thing with Ashley Judd. I mean, her last big role was... I mean, in terms of starring role, was way back when she was doing those movies with Morgan Freeman, the Alex Cross movies. Just as Need for Speed did not stick the landing on all the points that it needed to, Nonstop did 10 million, just about 10 million. And see, it's a little bit, actually beat out in its like third week of release, Tyler Perry's The Single Moms Club, which was terrible, at $8 million. And then knocks it on down. Grand Budapest Hotel was in eighth place with 3.6. It was only in 66 theaters. And then going down the list, the outside of the top 10, but still significant, was Veronica Mars, which made $2 million, which is actually pretty impressive, considering that it was just this funded Kickstarter campaign, and that did well, and you've got the video and all that, and additional revenues to come from that. Veronica Mars, even though it's a small number and it's outside the top 10, it was in less than 300 theaters, and it did pretty well for what it was. Let's talk now about our giveaway. We have a winner. This is, of course, for Ancient Aliens, Season 5, Volume 2. It's interesting. It's way more interesting than I thought. Actually, these later seasons, because they have to drill down and get something a little more specific instead of going something so broad like the earlier seasons of Ancient Aliens, it's actually a pretty good set. So congratulations to Lisa from San Luis Obispo, who emailed in and told us who her favorite alien was from movies or TV. She went on this long, rambling discussion about... all these different aliens, and she named a ton. I mean, she made My Favorite Martian, Mork from Ork, The Neighbors, Marvin the Martian, Spock, Superman, even Doctor Who, and she said David Tennant was her favorite, and I support that decision, although I'll never outgrow Tom Baker as the fourth Doctor. But Tennant was good, too. But this was her final statement on who her favorite alien is. She says, quote, "So to choose one very awesome and exciting alien is difficult, but not impossible. I choose Teal'c from Stargate SG-1. He rocked. Indeed." That's a good answer. I liked Teal'c. I thought he was a great character in that series. He really charmed you after you got through some several seasons. Stargate SG-1 was a bit rocky in its first couple seasons. It took some time to get its footing. But boy, when it did, it had some great episodes. And I will still always like Stargate Atlantis as a series a little bit better. And Teal'c showed up in that a couple times. My favorite thing, and just, Lisa, I'm sure you'll agree with me, my favorite Teal'c moment was when Teal'c from SG-1 and Ronan from Atlantis met each other and had a chance to go hand-to-hand combat. That was, my wife and I got a big kick out of that. So congratulations, Lisa. We will be sending you a copy of Ancient Alien Season 5, Volume 2 on Blu-ray. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's catch up on a couple more news items. Some just development news. One of the things is Gem and the Holograms is being made into a movie. Now, if you've never seen Gem and the Holograms, it's this wackadoodle cartoon from the 80s about a girl living a normal life and also being a rock star. No, it's not. Miley Cyrus is not involved in this at all. But this movie has charged a lot of people in the internet and fans of the show, I just hope it's as completely bonkers and insane and David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust type concerts that they have in the TV show. Another bit of development news, you've got Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are teaming up for a Netflix series. And yes, Dolly Parton is not involved. So, sorry, I don't know why. I don't know whether they just said, let's get these two, and they happen to have been in 9 to 5 in 1980, or if they just said, let's not even call Dolly Parton. The Netflix series is called Grace and Frankie, and it's going to be about two women whose husbands leave them for each other, and they kind of have to deal with the fact that they were originally sparring with each other, but they kind of become friends. A couple more pieces of news. You got Saw 8 coming out, but Lee Wannell is not going to have anything to do with it. I don't know if that's good or bad. Saw 8, it just really burned out by Saw 7. So I don't know if you can... Are they going to reboot? Just please don't go to found footage. That's all I have to say. No found footage. Give me anything in a Saw movie. Put my family in the Saw movie. Just don't put it as found footage. Insidious 3 gets a release date, which is April 3rd, 2015. Another 2015 date. And Sinister 2 gets a summer 2015 release date. So for horror fans, you've got a lot of stuff on the horizon. And that's about it, because that music means it's time to start talking about the DVD Roundup. Yeehaw! First of all, on the spotlight section, which I kind of highlight an older release that's not new, that I just think people should pick up and get a chance to watch, The Ricky Gervais Show, which is based on the podcast. It takes the podcasts that he and Carl Pilkington and Stephen Merchant do, and they animate them, and they put it on HBO, and there's been three volumes of it out on DVD and Blu-ray. You can also rent some of them on Amazon on demand. So if you've never watched this, it's hilarious. If you like the podcast, it is a brilliant version of it, because it has the characters doing what they're talking about. And Carl Pilkington is so hilarious in this, and he's such a moron at times, but he's got such heart. And it's a lot of it is just Ricky and Steven berating Carl the entire times, but it's brilliant. It's a great show. If you haven't had a chance to see it, check it out. Do not show it to your kids after watching The Muppets Most Wanted, because there's a lot of raw humor and blue language in it. So just usually Ricky Gervais goes for the adult audience. Anyways, let's talk about the movies that are out this week. First, topping the list, the best movie of the week for DVDs and Blu-rays is Frozen, the most charming Disney movie we've seen in a long time from their animated group. Won the Academy Award, won a ton of awards. It's a gorgeous movie with a song sung by Adele Dazeem and John Travolta in a beautiful duet. Frozen is a gorgeous movie. If you have not seen it, and most people have, because the movie's made doggone near $400 million in the United States or in North America alone. But if you haven't seen it, pick it up, watch it. It's worth getting the Blu-ray, because in a lot of as they do in all Disney movies, they give you a copy of the DVD. So if your kids watch it, and like if you got the back of the minivan, you can put a DVD in, or they can watch it if you got an old DVD player in the room or on their computer. It's very versatile. It also has digital copy available. Also from Disney, you've got Saving Mr. Banks, which is the story of, not the making of, but the story of the acquisition of Mary Poppins from P.L. Travers, played by Emma Thompson, and Walt Disney's played by Tom Hanks. It's a very heartwarming movie, and it's if you've ever been to Disney, I've been fortunate enough to go to the Disney studios, like behind the scenes, and see certain things. So there's the magic of that, and there's something electric and exciting about actually walking through not just the public areas of Disney, but just the behind the scenes and seeing the equipment they used. I saw the equipment they used to shoot the layered elements of Bambi and how they shot and how they processed the cells for 101 Dalmatians. This is getting back to that warm, lovely Disney charm that we've seen so many times in the past. So definitely, if you have a chance to see Saving Mr. Banks, it's a great movie. There's also American Hustle, award-winning film, with it stars Batman and Mystique and Hawkeye and Lois Lane. And it's a movie of the Abscam scandal. It's funny. It's not, I didn't think it was as great as everybody else did. I'm not a huge David O. Russell fan. I'll take Wes Anderson over him any day. There's also Kill Your Darlings, a smaller movie starring Harry Potter, or Daniel Radcliffe, as Allen Ginsberg, and his involvement in the Beat Poetry movement and the murder that he was involved with peripherally with Lucien Carr. it's worth checking out, especially if you read their works and you want to kind of go to that time again. Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, not that good of a movie, but it came out like right after Nelson Mandela died. So it kind of was a nice way to sort of frame his political persona and public persona. The stinker of the week is Jeff Dunham's Ahmed Saves America. Aren't we done with Jeff Dunham? Is he still around? That's it for this week. I am out of time. Next week, we're going to be taking it to the seas with Noah. We're going to be talking about Sabotage, Bad Words, and Enemy. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.